Russian tea room, her father's treat. He slipped me a $50 bill. Cherry duck and Matus. Then, into the Carnegie Bar, where all the NYC British rock fans are sitting out the first band. Some I recognize from the recent Faces concert. There's Rick Derringer. Suzanne buys me a couple of Pernods. Quite an array of peacocks, resplendent in velvet, feather boas, high heels, and those are just the boys. These creatures only come out at night. Inside the hall, it's all about to happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, after a long absence, the Kinks!
Ray Davies in a Dickensian stovepipe hat, tails, gap-tooth drunken grin, Telecaster with the price tag still on it. He bows like the music hall showman he is. We go Kinks crazy. Waterloo Sunset, Ape Man, Dead End Street, Wonder Boy, Barkley Muse, Big Black Smoke, King Kong, dedicated follower of fashion, and of course, their new AM radio hit, Lola, where Ray really camps it up. The next thing we know, it's the third encore, Louie Louie, and Ray is bidding us a good night. Back in snowy Minneapolis for Thanksgiving. Go to a party in someone's house. Angie's on the pill now. Tits grew, busting out of her Ruby Keeler dress. We drink too much Pernod, which has such an intense high. I rub her monkey. Girl and boy, little joys, ankles away. I go see the family doctor, who says I have arrhythmia or something, and I better quit smoking, drinking, and taking drugs. My dad says I'm pathetic, and that if I flunk out of college, I'm out of the family as well. Punk. January 1972. 19 years old. Draft physical, or how I became 4F. The war rages on, student deferments abolished. There's a lottery. Thinking about my good luck thus far, I assumed I'd get number 365, and they'd never get to me. Not so. There was my birthday in the New York Times, number 30. Uncle Sam wants me. I met with a local draft resistance organization to plot my disqualification. Otherwise, I'd have to hightail it to Montreal. They were very helpful, but warned me that the military had become very jaded, and the days of getting out by wearing pink lace underpants were long gone. For my height, 5'9", I needed to weigh at least 120 to pass the physical. I weighed 123. I stopped eating, kept drinking, smoking, with no food, except for the occasional hard-boiled egg. I lost 20 pounds in 2 weeks. I got a note from the family doctor which explains that I had Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome with a short PR interval that gave me an irregular heartbeat. Said that military service would be hazardous to my health. So, one ominous gray morning, my dad drops me off at the hoary downtown building where the physicals take place. I stand in line in my boxer shorts in a dim, drafty corridor with all the farm boys from rural Minnesota. My ribs stick through my white skin. I put a little rouge on my cheeks in the bathroom to accentuate my pallor. When I get up to the scale, it says 103. The guy writes down 120. Look, it says 103, I blurt out. The jerk chuckles and says, maybe I need glasses. Move along, kid. But wait, I cry. It's not fair. Tough luck, kid. Now move along. Uh-oh. My ace in the hole was just removed. We put our clothes back on and sat on benches filling out forms on clipboards. I was frightened and lightheaded. I checked all the boxes, alcoholic, drug addict, homosexual. After a long wait, I was sent to an office where a burly man with a crew cut read my chart. I gave him the doctor's letter. He read it and said, "Well, this is pretty vague. I don't think we need to concern ourselves with this," and threw it in the wastebasket. One more line of defense gone. He asked me what I drank. "A quart of scotch a day, and a six-pack or two." "Mm-hmm," he said. "What about the drugs?" "Anything I can get. Lots of LSD. I suffer from acid flashbacks a lot. I'm never sure when the acid will come on again. It's pretty weird." "Mm-hmm." "Well, you won't be able to get your hands on any of that where you're going." "Fuck! This is going all wrong." "You checked the homosexual box. What's that about?" "What about it?" I replied flatly. "I mean, are you actively homosexual?" he said with some distaste. I said, just as cool as could be, "Yeah, sure, I've always been queer," and shrugged. "Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about that. I'm going to send you to our psychiatrist so he can evaluate you. He'll sort this out." He stamped some papers and handed them to me with a look of disgust in his face. "Go to room 211 and wait outside until you're called." I left his office and wandered down the hall, past the farm boys, who had already been classified 1A, and would be in boot camp in March. They'd be in Saigon by summer. Soldiers! Trying to kill North Vietnamese teenagers. Trying not to step on landmines. Fuck! I sat on my bench waiting, shivering. Actually hallucinating from starvation. What now? I'd not prepared for this. The army was taking some homosexuals. Which kind didn't they like? I didn't even know. They'd seen it all. They needed numbers. Everybody was gone. I couldn't fabricate a plan. I was going to have to wing it. Eventually, I was called into the psychiatrist's office. Sitting at a big wooden desk was a mousy little man. "Have a seat, Mr. Hanna." I walked over to his desk and hiked myself up on it, crossed my legs, and looked at him dead on through my long bangs. "In the chair, Mr. Hanna," he said, unnerved. I said, "I'm fine here. Why, am I making you nervous?" and laughed. "In the chair," he said in a panicky voice. I leaned over and picked up a framed photo of a dowdy female and studied it. "Who's this? Your wife?" and threw it to the floor with a leer. "Mr. Hanna, I must insist you remove yourself from my desk and sit down in that chair." I slowly got up and positioned myself in the chair, all the while smiling at him with contempt. "Now, about your sexuality, what exactly do you mean by this? I mean, what is the nature of these homosexual leanings?" "What is the nature of my leanings?" I answered, laughing sarcastically. And so began my perverse soliloquy on the nature of my fictitious sex life. It was like an out-of-body experience. I could hear my voice describing sodomy and cocksucking, but I wasn't aware of composing any of it in my mind. It was like speaking in tongues. It just flowed out unfiltered, describing things I'd never even heard of. As if I was actually enjoying myself in front of this funny little man. He was very agitated, looking down at my file, fiddling with his pen. "I see, and, does this predilection of yours ever lead to any kind of trouble?" "All the time, Doc. You see, I feel that everyone has a little bit of queer in them, some more than others. My favorites are straight. I cleared my throat. Men. If they don't like it, it often leads to violence, which is fine by me. It turns me on, gets me hard. It's like I'm on a mission. I don't take no for an answer. I'm gonna have fun in boot camp. Those bunk beds, all those boys in their BVDs. That's like a dream come true for me. I'm gonna... And I continued with my graphic description of the lewd mayhem I was going to wreak at Fort Bragg, or wherever the fuck they planned on sending me. "That's enough, Mr. Hanna," he said, waving me to stop. He reached for a stamp. "I'm afraid, under the circumstances, I find you unfit for military duty." And with that, his stamp came down in my form, leaving a bold red 4F behind it. I kept up my chatter, as if I was now pissed off at this outcome, railing at the poor little schmuck, clearly out of his depth here. He held out the paper and said, "Please leave my office now, Mr. Hanna." I made a dramatic exit, slammed the door behind me, and then the spell was over. My spirit floated up to the dingy ceiling, looked down on my frail 103-pound self, standing on the old green linoleum, wondering what had just happened. Was it some kind of divine intervention? Who said those words? Where'd they come from? It was the performance of my lifetime. My dad picked me up in his orange Fiat Spider and said, "Well, how'd it go?" 4F, I beamed. "Was it the doctor's note?" "Nope." "Was it your weight?" "Nope." "Well, then what was it?" "Oh, I guess they just realized I wouldn't be much good over there." "And how did they realize that?" he asked, now suspicious, ever the lawyer. "Oh, they just sent me to talk to a couple of doctors, you know." Long silence. "I hope you haven't done anything you'll regret later. These things are on your record forever." "Yeah, but it's not like I'm going to run for president or anything. I'm going to be an artist." "What did you do?" he asked ominously. "Nothing. I just saved myself from getting shipped over to Vietnam and committing suicide. I'm sure that's what I would have done in the face of all that horror, turn the gun on myself." Great relief in having literally dodged a bullet. The sword of Damocles no longer hangs over my head. Now that that's over, it's something called field period. 1 month off from Bard where I'm supposed to work independently. Parents went to Europe. Have the house to myself. Living on Bloody Marys, screwdrivers, Pernod. Enjoying being a spoiled kid on a tear. I just got a flip. Gone. Real gone. Solid gone. January 8th, 1972. I was reading the morning paper and saw an obituary for the poet John Berryman, 58. I'd never heard of him. He was teaching at the U of M, was depressed, and jumped off the Washington Avenue Bridge on the West Bank side. He missed the water and smothered in the mud, a semi-botched suicide. There was a picture of him in his black glasses and long beard. The thing is, I recognized him. Us druggy brothers used to see him around the West Bank, after we'd scored our acid and hit the Electric Fetus for albums, Rolling Papers, and Zap Comics. Once when we were all tripping, we walked over to him at the foot of the Washington Avenue Bridge, same place where he leapt. It was snowing, and he had his arms wrapped around him because of the cold, like he was waiting for somebody. We didn't know who he was, but he seemed to be a cool old guy. Very drawn, like he'd really lived. So we just started yakking in our disconnected, stoned way, and he listened, without saying much. We asked him what he was doing, standing by a bridge in the bitter winter wind. He was noncommittal. We thought maybe he was a lunatic or a holy bum, some kind of seer. We had many theories on who this lonely stranger might be. It never occurred to us he was a professor or a celebrated poet, although we did think he was touched in equal parts with madness and genius. Just because of the way he absorbed our nonsense and looked into us without judgment. I only knew him as John. Poor guy. Now he's dead. Drunk. Empty Kenwood house. I knocked over a Christmas tree. I cracked my head open on a radiator. Blood. Woke up and ate an omelet, then drank some more while I smoked a cigar in the tub with Kramer, listening to The Wizard of Oz. Later, all of us naked boys in a living room listening to a parakeet training record. Hello, baby. Want a kiss? Hello, baby. Want a kiss? Later, it kept skipping on the word Henry. 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 Over and over. Later, at yet another party, in another basement, I pulled Lucy Hood over to my place in the couch, sat her on my lap, and started kissing her Susanna York lookalike face. I slid my fingers up into her snatch and whispered that we should find a quiet spot and make love. I want to so bad you can't even know, but I just can't, she replied, adding that I had the most beautiful smile in the world. I got her up in the attic anyhow, got her undies off, but she wouldn't go all the way. Still, very exciting. Pretty blonde prep school girl, very passionate on the plank floor. Angie comes over to read as I paint Marlon Brando. One thing leads to another. Bubblegum breasts. Now she's just got on green tights, very attractive and coquettish. Take those off. Then we get down to it. She's spiraling around my joint with her inner contractions. She calls me a playful little shit. Loves me by the hour. Kramer, Haskell, and I spending an afternoon in their slum apartment, drinking Muscatel. The tenants are mostly Native American winos. This neighborhood is loosely called Indian Town. The boys call up a hippie floozy they know, name of Nancy, with a slack look in her face. And we cajole her into a bedroom and take turns on her supine body. At least, sort of. I couldn't do it. I don't think they could either. Too weird. Not sexy. Ruthless youth. Is this all part of a rake's progress? Or maybe we're just obnoxious creeps? Grades from Bard arrived. Here's what my advisor, Jake Grossberg, Larry Rivers' cousin, writes. You have facility, but settle for devices rather than pushing towards a personal means of arriving at drawing. The only clue as to how one does this, I can give you, is to examine where the devices you use come from. You've a wonderful facility, but a self-indulgent, silly attitude towards your work. When you start to make demands of yourself, you will do fine work. That I believe. But you settle for banality, frivolity, and easy effect. It's a real loss. Honors. Back at Bard, Lloyd and I kicked off the new semester with a bottle of Pernod. We hit the ping-pong room, and I shot Lloyd with a fire extinguisher. Campus security tracked me down, and I was summoned to the dean's office the following Monday. And now I'm on probation. I run into Doc Bray in the hallway. You look different, I say. Oh, yeah, I had my eyeballs removed, he says casually. Interesting guy. Reading Tropic of Cancer. Miller is cunt crazy. I want to fuck you so you'll stay fucked. Last week I thought I was an artist. Today I am, Miller writes. The Blythewood Ghost, Part 1. Patty was in my painting class. Loved Virginia Woolf. lived in a girl's dorm at the end of a road, Blythewood Manor, an enormous 1900 white mansion, sitting on a bluff high above the Hudson. The blue Catskills across the river. The jewel in the crown of Bard's various buildings. Lots of big white pillars, statuary, formal Italianate gardens, gazebos, a fountain. Real Henry James grandeur. Patty and I were painting late in the empty art building, and she invited me over to spend the night, platonically. She was going through a sapphic phase. I did, and we lay on her mattress in her room on the top floor, talking and smoking the night away. I heard a ooh, and said, "Cool, you can hear the train from your room." "That's not the train. That's the woman upstairs." "Some student lives in the attic?" "Not a student," Patty said calmly. "It's the spirit who lives here."
"What?"
Patty smiled at me. "Okay, this is the story. At the end of the 19th century, two families arranged a marriage between their kids. A power marriage between two aristocratic families. Their wedding present was to be a Hudson River mansion to be passed down through the generations. They picked a stylish architect of the time, Francis Hoppen, from McKim, Mead, and White. And it was suggested that Francis, the bride-to-be, oversee some of the construction, so it would be tailor-made for the couple. While doing so, she fell in love with the architect, and they embarked on a secret affair, Francis and Francis. They used to make love in the attic. We know this because she kept a diary. The wedding date was approaching, and the architect pleaded with her to call it off and run off with him. Maybe California. She said she couldn't go against her father's wishes. So, heavy-hearted, she married her intended, and off they went to Europe on their grand tour honeymoon. She sank into a deep depression, and on their return, when they moved into the now-completed Blythewood, her depression became critical. She knew she'd made the mistake of her life. She finally couldn't stand it anymore and hanged herself from a beam in the attic, dressed only in her nightgown. She lives here still, and we often see her walking in the garden at night.
"You all see her? Everyone here knows?"
"Yes," Patty laughed. "It's quite fitting, don't you think, for a girl's dorm? She's one of us. She's our sister."
"Wow. So that was her we heard?"
"Yes, she's still sad. I hear her most nights," Patty said solemnly. Then a train did pass by under the cliff on its way north, and we heard its woo, woo, clearly not from upstairs. As if on cue, we heard again a mournful moan from above, then another. Chilling, a cry from a broken-hearted young woman who's been dead for 70 years. I went up to the attic the next morning, a large, mostly empty, rough-hewn space with an old ladder leading up to the roof. There were large dormer windows looking out over the lawns and gardens, a stack of La Illustration magazines from the 20s and 30s. I looked at the beams and wondered which one took her weight. Baudelaire says, "Talent is nothing more or less than childhood rediscovered at will, a childhood now equipped for self-expression with manhood's capabilities and a power of analysis which enables it to order the mass of raw material which it has involuntarily accumulated." I've been getting some pretty heavy letters from my parents telling me to grow up and stop being such a bizarre version of Peter Pan. They seem to think I'm a transvestite. My mother got a letter from the cops saying she was going to get arrested in 5 days if she didn't pay my traffic ticket. Well, there aren't any parents here. Call me irresponsible, call me unreliable, call me undeniably blue. Robert Wyatt sings, "Time wasted, time that could be spent completely nude and naked." "Bang a Gong, Get It On" is number one on WABC AM radio. T-Rex, baby! Just in time for Bolan's British invasion of America. Melody Maker, I'm a subscriber, has featured him on the cover for weeks as T-Rex mania sweeps England. Exciting! Going to see them on Sunday. Weekend in New York. A black limousine picks up Suzanne and me, courtesy of her grandfather. Black driver named Julius drives us from Annandale-on-Hudson to Woodmere, Long Island. Dinner with her eccentric parents. We stay up, watching Village of the Damned, while I work my way through a bottle of Napoleon brandy. To Manhattan in the morning, incredible pop art of Times Square, the juxtaposition of billboards and neon and the steaming cup of Salada tea and blinking Coca-Cola and marquees and the camel smoke ring sign. It's one big collage. Then St. Mark's Place, still wearing the vestiges of the Aquarian Age. Super graphics on the side of brick buildings, faded rainbows, tattered hipsters on the drizzly street. An old lady pleads for cha-cha records. We take pictures of each other posing like we see on album covers. Buy a couple of shirts in limbo. Dinner at Wo Ping in Chinatown with Lloyd. 57th Street, spotlights outside Carnegie Hall shoot silvery beams of light over the Deco cityscape. Getting primed for the much-awaited rock show in the ornate red and gold bar beforehand. All the cool cats have come out of their coffins for the T-Rex debut in NYC. They are a sight to behold. I like the flash ugly ones with their hooked noses and souped-up hair, gaunt scarecrows wearing patchworks of silks and satins and velvets, lots of gold bracelets and rings, hunched over, teetering on their high heels, fops to the left of me, dandies to their right, jammed with the creme de la creme of rock aristocracy, even Candy Darling. It looks like the court of Louis XVI in here. Showtime. Mark struts out wearing a Bolan t-shirt under his white lamé suit, only 5'4" tall, mincing and preening, playing his sunburst Les Paul, playing Hot Love and Jeepster. Crowd goes wild, girls screaming, crying, fainting, and getting carried out by security, pissing in their seats. He's laughing and doing his Chuck Berry thing. It's a short, sloppy set, but the teen idol mayhem makes it thrilling. Bombardier. April 1972. I run into handsome guitarist Rob Dupre in the showers. He says, "Hey, are you the guy who plays that punk music?" "I don't know. What's punk music?" "You know, the Stooges. I can hear it through the door. It's okay. I love the Stooges." So now he's trying to teach me to sing so we can form a band. Our set list. Schoolgirl, Argent. Little Doll, Real Cool Time, Stooges. Curly, Tonight, Omnibus, Move. Nellie Takes Her Bow, Whisper in the Night, ELO. Call Me Animal, MC5. After a week of dedicated alcohol consumption, I'm run down. I have ravished myself out of my senses. I can't remember Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights at all. I got the feeling of impending doom. My fingernails are ragged. My drowned heart feels funny like it's got a knife in it. I'm not right. I is sick, depraved, deranged, paranoid. I can't sleep because I'll die. I got restless tension, bad circulation, no oxygen in my brain, never-ending shakes. I'm weak, hallucinations. Can this be DTs? Aren't I too young for DTs? I'm so goddamn young. There's a shadow looming over me.
I lie in my single bed and look up at the creepy portrait of Fu Manchu that I finished, acrylic on canvas, dressed in the height of aristocratic Chinese crime boss fashion. A plume of opium smoke drifts up to his cat's eyes. Why am I obsessed by Fu Manchu? Thinking about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There's been a lot of Mr. Hyde lately. I grit my teeth and tough it out. I had a dream of living in a Chinese junk in the foghorn darkness. A bunk bed lit by a Chinese lamp. Smell of opium. A coppery quilt, a boyish girl, oval mouth, wide, dark, heavy-lidded eyes, long-fingered. My freckled feline imp arches, coaxes, slips, churns, seethes, nuzzles, boils, baits, softly crashes into me over and over. Whew. My subconscious is starved for Eros. It's been a while. I've almost forgotten there's a little creature that lives between every pair of female legs. I want to get on my camel and ride. I learned painting is about painting. We paint for ourselves and other painters. It's not just what you put in, but also what you leave out. I dig Marcarelli lately. He's got a great feel for shapes. April 21st, 1972. Woke up this morning with a bird's nest in my head. Those seconals weren't too good for me, cardiac-wise. Went to the bar last night with Paul Morrissey, who had just shown Chelsea Girls at the campus screening room. We told jokes for 4 hours. Another barroom drama was when I found poet Fielding Dawson, great name, on a stool, nursing a hangover at around noon. I heard him read the night before. We split a pitcher of beer and he told me about his pals, the abstract expressionists. Pretty funny stories about the Cedar Tavern, involving belligerent beatniks, and especially Franz Klein, who I like a lot. I got up to pee and suddenly he was in the can too, mauling me. "Knock it off, man," I yelled, pushing him off. He was persistent, so I kneed him in the ghoulies, and took off out of the joint, very disappointed that our dipsomaniac communion should have had to end this way. Saw Satyricon. Loved Ashito, Hiram Keller, the brawling, lusty demigod, grinning with self-assurance. Many pretty boys abound. Stupendous sets. Used for a minute or so. I get a letter from Angie. She writes, "I am making 2 new dresses, especially for you. One is Hubba Hubba, and the other is Whisper Me Sweet Nothings. They are the kind that when you see me in them, you want to see me out of them, you old rooster." Bard is like a country club with no golf course. Baghdad on the Hudson. Sunbathing on the Blythewood roof, slathered in copper tone. The comforting smell that takes me back to Miami Beach in the 50s. I can hear the hushed drone of the waterfall through the trees. I can hear the birds singing, hear my pen scritching. Somewhere, someone is playing Opportunity by Eddie Cochran. Boys Night Out Department. Rob Dupre, the libertine, and I fulfilled our orgy fantasies last night, scrambling round on naked classmates. Social climber Mallory and her pal, a girl called Andy, drove us home from the bar in her Alfa Romeo, and we went in Rob's empty room. Threw on some soft machine, lit her joint, and we got down to it. Sex for sex's sake, and the sheer whee of women. Mallory's taller than me, short hair and hard brown nubbin nipples. Pubic hair trimmed like a small hedge. Huge vagina. She seemed no stranger to this kind of scene. Rob and Andy next to us, copulating away. I catch Rob's eye. A twinkle of amusement passes between us. I think the girls found us a little too nutty. They were trying to be sophisticated, but it was hard to take seriously, Hard to be cool.
May 5th, 1972. Dupre and I hit New York City to see the Jeff Beck Group at Carnegie Hall, featuring his fabulous drummer, Cozy Powell. First, we load up on Pernod till we get a nice buzz going. Beck is ripping it up in his bad boy way. One of the best guitarists ever, a real connoisseur of sounds, from dirty to lyrical. He's got that great shag haircut that I made my mother try to replicate when she cut my hair. Dark eye sockets, played Stratocaster over his head, sounding like the dragsters he loves, laughing at the mayhem he conjures up. Some hippies bounce a balloon up to the stage, and he stomps it flat immediately with his Cuban heels. No summer of love here, son. This is a crack team of professionals. Going down, ice cream cakes, and the gorgeous Raines Park Blues. It is loud and it feels good. What a fucking band. After the show, Dupre and I run down Fifth Avenue in drunken high spirits, a myriad of lights and fountains and yellow cabs with a clear black New York City sky above us. We accost a couple of girls we never saw before, and one says, "Wait, is your name Duncan Hanna?" And I say, "Yeah!" And we run off because it was too perfect. Who's she? Streets, you better get out of the way. Howling at the moon, we got the devil in us. The next day, however, I got the DTs again while standing in the Met. I started to fade away. My vision was going. I thought, this is too melodramatic. I can't die in the Met, right in front of Sergeant's Madam X. I sat down at a bench. I didn't think I'd make it, and almost didn't. My dad's been writing me man-to-man letters in his open, loopy handwriting. We were so close up until the age of 14 or so. I was the child of his dreams back then. I remember eating scrambled eggs in the sunroom of the Plaza, dressed in my little Brooks Brothers getup, complete with a gray leather Eton cap. He brimmed over with pride. Now he wonders, what hath God wrought? But I'm a logical extension of that other Duncan. I'm not sure he sees it that way. Jake Grossberg, my drawing teacher, is exasperated with us students. We don't work hard enough. He blew up. He ripped up Elliot Kaplan's homework drawing into small pieces and threw it in his face. Said he wasn't here to babysit us. In my day, the kids were exciting and the teachers were dull. Now it's the other way around. He storms out of the studio, slamming the door behind him. Elliot is in tears. We look around at each other. Now what? We are guilty as charged. Bard is an odd reality. Szabo Stanislaw is a beautiful blonde theater major, the acknowledged stunner of the campus. One night in the coffee shop, someone runs in and says, "Quick, get down to the arts building. Szabo's modeling for life class." Who could have hoped for anything more glorious? I grab my pad and charcoals and sprint down there into the hush of the studio. There she stands in her altogether, frozen in a dance position, like an Aang Odalisque or a Playboy playmate. Perfect. I hurriedly set up at an easel and let my eyes feast over her supple dancer's body. She watched me out of her mysterious gray eyes, the hint of a smile at her lip. How her maize-colored hair frames her gorgeous face. The long neck settles into the chest, the swell of the upturned breast with nipples at attention, the ribcage, the navel, the southern slope down to the furred sex, the hip meeting the thigh, faster now south to the long legs and feet. How could one do justice to this vision of beauty? It's all made of creams and blushes, the poetry of her dips and hollows. She's not made out of lines. Lines don't exist here. At the break, she stretches, slowly puts on her kimono, and comes over to look at my lousy drawing. I apologize for not rising to the level of her loveliness. She's amused at the power she has, not just over me, but over the entire room. She's casually flirtatious. Toys with me.
Somehow the fact that she's naked under her silk wrapper flusters me even more. Says she enjoys modeling, makes a little pocket money. The teacher says it's time to resume, and she leaves me to go back to her altar to be our goddess again. She adopts a reclining pose with her legs slightly parted. Her quim is aimed right at me, winks at me. I'm staring hard, trying to memorize every detail for future reference. At the end of the session, I've not captured the apparition before me at all. My drawings lack grace. I watched as she climbed back into her baggy blue jeans, worn cowboy boots, flannel shirt, and brown leather airman's jacket. She gave me a lift in her old Volvo down to Adolph's, where a night of heavy drinking took place. I got up with no memory of pissing off the landing onto the stairs. So alcoholized that my teeth were chattering. Trudge over to my painting class. Jim Sullivan says, "In the beginning, you tried to paint compelling paintings that forced us to look at them, but held our attention for a minimal time, because you used so many gimmicks. Now, they're toned down and much more compelling." I play nursemaid to my paintings, trying to give them what they need rather than what I want. The school year is drawing to a close. I stock up on Pernod in the liquor shop in nearby Red Hook for the parties to come. A big, confusing blur of bad behavior. Freshman year is over. Summer of 1972, Minneapolis. My dad is shocked at my appearance. He says I'm a disgrace to Fred Astaire. Says to Mom, "He's really flipped this time." They're worried about drunk driving, rightly so. No more car keys. "We want to be proud of you, but we can't. When you were a little boy, we had such high hopes for you, but each year we lower our expectations." Talking about alcohol with Dad over three scotch and waters in the backyard, abuzz with mosquitoes. "We're trying to put the brakes on you because you're too fun-loving. It's abnormal." He hires me to paint the house, which is covered in cedar shakes, but lots of trim and screen and storm windows. Then I can go to London in August to infiltrate the underground, make the club circuit in my flash fineries. June sky is dark and threatening, now raining on the lush woods. I'm alone in my room listening to Tyrannosaurus Rex. 1 Year by Colin Blunstone, exquisitely romantic, and Rawlinson Inn by the Bonzo Dog Band. I feel like I haven't been alone in ages. I leaf through picture books and paint a little, calm for the first time in a long time. Here I am in a backwater of Hopkins, once the juvenile delinquent capital of Minnesota. The hood still bombed down the main drag and hopped up pink Camaros. On the local scene, Kramer and I ride a bicycle built for two and crash gleefully into trees, small children in walls. No one is hospitalized. Calm disrupted by David Bowie's new album, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. He outdoes T-Rex. This is the next big step. Can't stop listening to it. Makes me freak out in a moon-age daydream. June 17th. The nice thing about having a lover is that it makes you think about everything anew. The rest of your life becomes a kind of movie, flat and rather funny. "Inspirations have I none, just a touch of flaming love," sings Bowie. My mom notices my shredded back, which comes from Lainey Powell's fingernails. How I got my stripes goes like this. Lainey, Kramer's ex, called me in the afternoon and said, "Wait until you see my new haircut. You're gonna love it. We'd make the perfect pair." Okay. She said she'd meet me later at a party in an empty house in Hopkins. There she is, busty Lainey in lederhosen, with her new Ziggy Stardust haircut. She looks like a super sexy Swiss tomboy. We have instant chemistry after the ice-breaking, flirtatious phone call this afternoon. It is on. Go into the dark basement away from the noise and I slide my fingers up under her knit top and fondle the glory of her tits. Soul kissing, look deep into her glittering eyes, she says, "Let's take a shower," which we did. Good idea. Which led to soaping and drying and then to bed, which was delicious, her long legs locked around mine as we gently rocked. Lainey's a carnal girl, a sensualist, a favorite with the summer boys in Excelsior. It's what she's best at, and she knows it, takes pride in her amorous physicality, which is nice, exhilarating, in fact. My parents left for a party at 6, so, since I'm grounded, my pals came to me with lots of rum. Make-up party ensued. Parents came home early at 10. Joint was hoppin'. Trouble. I started bowing and oming like the mystic magic mullah magi. Mom is pretty blotto herself and holds her head in her hands. Dunk's got a lot of problems and you don't help him any. Please get out of this house pronto. They left. In the morning, I got up. Little sergeant at salute, head pounding, heart doing fills and paradiddles, skin too tight, took a shower, made an omelet. Mom comes in, shit hitting the fan, and says, "I've lost faith in you. You're a worthless, no-good, homosexual choir boy." I laughed at that one and countered with, "Well, I don't like you or your ding-a-ling friends either." "You're driving me to an early grave," she yelled. Just to wind her up a bit more, I told her how I really got out of the draft. She went wiggy over that one. She ridicules what she don't understand. Home alone on a gloomy summer's day, Lainey calls to say she's been thinking about that party. Could she come over and see me? Take the bus? Sure. Bing bong. She shows up at the doorstep looking a bit shy and sheepish. My heart fluttered. She looks fabulous in pleated pants and a little Fair Isle top. Very Bowie. My puss in boots. I make drinks and lead her into my room to listen to records. We kiss, more sober than last time. And we take off our clothes in stages. She's just 17 years old. She's my height, flat stomach, with a row of taut muscles that run down to where our pubic hairs meet. She tells me she's sterile, so don't worry about birth control. We make love 3 times that afternoon. She's more comfortable in the throes of passion than she is at making conversation. Lovely lying next to her, still messy with fairy dust. "I don't feel dirty or slutty going to bed with you," she says. "You're so pretty and appreciative. It's really nice." I felt like a regular rogue running her home in Dad's low-slung convertible sports car, dropping her off at the house of her fat mom, who's in the driveway, wearing a flowered apron. She throws her pudgy arms around her daughter as I squeal off, saying, "Bye-bye, ducks." My dad looks at my attire and says, "Wouldn't you rather be Humphrey Bogart than Lauren Bacall?" I'm talking to a Jehovah's Witness at the front door, and "Sympathy for the Devil" comes on the living room stereo. Nice timing. Memorable night with the wild boys and girls of our extended pack. Wound up at Cousin Swanee's house on Lake Minnetonka. Full house, so Lainey and I were given the sleeping porch, enclosed with screens, which has a large bed suspended by chains to the ceiling. That night, there was a crazy thunderstorm, so we fucked our way through it with primitive passion. Sacred fucking in a second-story porch as the heavens exploded. Then we took a bath, facing each other, such cuteness to behold. Made it again in the bath while a David Bowie record played from downstairs. Back to our swinging bed for a snuggle, which led to about 3. Lainey loves it, which is such a turn-on. Desire is the ultimate aphrodisiac. I like being wanted. I like being part of someone else's hunger. Jimmy and I were summoned up to an island on Rainy Lake in Winnipeg by Gail Bennett. She's an heiress. And her friend Sybil. part of the girls' school clique. We were flown in the two-engine, five-seat company plane, just the two of us and the pilot. We ran into an ultra-heavy storm a mile up. We were pitched upside down, our cokes in the ceiling, and the plane began twitching and clanking and dropped altitude like a loose elevator. The pilot was scared shitless. Our knuckles were white, and Jimmy and I, friends since 1959, said our solemn goodbyes to each other. Strangely enough, my heart was beating calmly for the first time since Easter. The plane that had lost its bearings suddenly righted itself, and we came out of the storm. We made it. When we touched down, we kissed the tarmac. Alive! We spent 5 days with the girls in this rustic compound, a main lodge and some cabins, sailing on a sunfish, canoeing, drinking rye whiskey, skinny-dipping. We told ghost stories in the double-sided white sand beach one night, spooking the girls. Electrical storms broke out, lightning flashes zapping the aluminum lawn chairs at 10-second intervals. Pzzz. It was something to see. Our eyes were popping out at the extreme violence of nature. That night, Jimmy snuck out of our cabin to join Gail, and Sybil came a-knocking at my door. I like Sybil, but I wasn't about to get into this. She had a mass of kinky hair, webbed toes, a forehead like the Rock of Gibraltar, saggy tits, and breath that smelled like buckskin scraps. I did not comply, but I was diplomatic about it. Back in suburbia, Lainey comes over to meet with my parents. She's sitting in the beamed living room, nursing a scotch and soda, and smoking a Parliament 100, dressed in pleated Busby Berkeley pants and no underwear. The dinner conversation is about the various merits of a high school education and the pointlessness of memorization. Meanwhile, my dad is ogling her, his eyes all a-twinkle. They tell me in the kitchen that this is the nicest girl I've ever brought home. If they only knew the half of it. I feel like a teenage werewolf. Free love abounds. This is a time of great urgency. We have no free will. We are controlled by our chemistry and electricity. What a weird summer. Been through the ringer of all the emotions. This summer I rode a roller coaster, had a troublesome heart condition, went to Canada and almost died, painted the house, held grudges, got in a car accident, played drums with the Hurricane Boys, made the scene at the country club, saw Todd Rundgren in concert, learned the Funky Penguin, saw an Egon Schiele show, drank a lot, screwed a pretty girl named Kit in the cabin of a sailboat, adored David Bowie, all in 60 days. Night of Absinthe. Party at Cousin Swanee's Lakeshore House in Deep Haven, and we have a bottle of real 1915 absinthe with the dreaded wormwood root ingredient that drives you insane, which got it banned worldwide. Steve Brooks, who looks like Thor Heyerdahl, has an older brother, Conley Jr. He was safekeeping the contraband stuff for his uncle, who brought it back from World War I. Kramer stole it while rummaging around during a cacophonous party at the Brooks's. So we were taking hits off it. It was so strong that when you forced a little sip down, it turned around halfway and tried to come back up. We were standing by the shore of the lake, taking it methodically, being connoisseurs of substance abuse, waiting for the click. I take a piss. There's a thunderstorm brewing. Two pale figures are coming up out of the dark, cold and naked. It's Calvin Perry and Lainey. She starts to cry when she sees me, scared of what I must think. But I don't think anything. I'm just drinking absinthe and taking a piss. I help her with her clothes. Her mascara is running down her face. Kramer's playing Parisian street songs and his accordion. We work on the absinthe a bit more, going down easier now. Calvin has entered the party house naked, bellowing some drivel about his godlike status. We decide this hippie scene is dead, time to move. We pile into Kramer's mother's station wagon. We don't know it, but we're nuts. Absinthe doing what absinthe does best. Kramer peels out. Partygoers are screaming, "No, don't let those guys drive, they're crazy!" Kramer is going 50 miles an hour through residential Deep Haven's windy wooded roads. Kurt and I are grumbling about the complacent dullards at the party. "We gotta go, man. There's a hellhound on our trail." Kramer's taking swipes at the steering wheel without actually touching it. We careen around a corner and slam into a tree. Wham! No brakes, nothing. Just wham! The tree broke. The car broke. Bent in two. Totaled. Car horn screaming. Smoke rising to obscure the moon. We are untouched. Blessed be the drunks. Only perturbed that now we have no means of transportation. Yelling at Kramer for being a crap driver. The party sent a pursuit car after us, knowing we wouldn't make it far. Kurt and I pile in, take off to his house. Kramer decides he better stay with the car, but realizes he better be scarce when the cops show up. So he creeps down into the swamp, up to his neck, like he saw in war movies. Police search for owner of abandoned station wagon to no avail. He's breathing through a reed underwater. Meanwhile, Lainey is in the car that picked us up. She wants to explain her behavior. "I don't care. I'm numb to jealousy tonight." She's feeling bawdy, sexually compulsive. When we get to Kurt's, we lock ourselves in the bathroom and fuck like nymphomaniacs on the floor. We had orgasms at the same time. What a rush. Absinthe did as advertised. Mumbles. August 1972. Next stop, London, with $770 in my sailor pants pocket. TWA to London, where I'm meeting Kramer for a glam rock holiday. Check my bag in Victoria Station. It's London. Pale dolly birds with red lips and high cheekbones swish by in plaid miniskirts. Soft blue pleated hot pants. Platform sandals. Coal-rimmed eyes, electric heads of hair. Can't figure out the money, but a pound means 5 pints of courage. Jukebox plays summer chartbuster All the Young Dudes, an anthem for this time. We hit the shops on King's Road, Mr. Freedom, where I pick up some black velvet overalls that I've seen both Bolan and Bowie wearing in the rock magazines. And Granny takes a trip. Maroon leather jacket and loon pants. Biba is Art Nouveau chic. Mirrors, emaciated birds with brown lipstick, tottering about in automatic shoes. We make quite the anglophilic pair, eating fish and chips with plenty of vinegar, pint of Watney's, topped off by an embassy cigarette. We ride the red double-decker bus to Hyde Park. Kramer's chasing the pigeons, saying, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty." The first night, we stayed with a Scot called Tommy, whose accent was so thick we couldn't understand a word he said. Kramer met him at a pub called The Cock, where he played God Save the Queen on an upright piano. So, of course, Tommy turns out to be a bugger boy and threatens to climb in with us at the end of the night. He produces an 8-inch razor and says something like, "Get in there, you fucking bastard!" Kramer tells him that if he touches either of us, he'll cut off his balls with that thing. Seems to calm Tommy down. Everyone is very friendly, although it's the homosexual population that we seem to be attracting, which appears to be quite large. We are taken for a couple of bent boys everywhere we go, when it's only rock and roll that we're after. Kramer's golden locks and Mick Jagger lips, my peekaboo shag and sailor suit seem to be sending out the wrong message. I looked in time out, and lo and behold, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars are playing two shows at the Rainbow. We get tickets immediately. But first, it's the Reading